And then the consequentialist argument essentially would also endorse just picking someone young and healthy off the street, opening them up and taking away their money. And I'm Andy, and this is the Accented Philosophy podcast brought to you by dailyphilosophy.com.
Every Tuesday, we discuss and explain the deeper issues behind the news
so that you can understand the real problems and make better decisions in your own life. So welcome, everyone. We are back to our Accented Philosophy podcast. And today, we want to talk about chimeras, as I learned they are called, beings that include cells from different species of organisms, and particularly problematic, of course, animals that include human cells. My name is Andy.
Hi, I'm Ezekiel.
Yeah, and this whole thing is based on an Guardian article. We always try to root these in some thing that is in the news, and there was a Guardian article a while ago on the 15th of May 2021, Mixed Messages, Is Research into Human-Monkey Embryos Ethical? And in there was discussed this, what is in essence a philosophical problem of having cells of human beings implanted into monkeys, and the idea is to produce organs for human transplants. This is what the whole concept is. So you suppress the development of a kidney in a monkey, and instead you put human cells in there that can develop into a kidney, and then your monkey develops a human kidney, which later is available for transplanting.
Yes. And also, I think we should mention that this was the first time that this experiment was a success, I believe. And scientists destroyed the embryo after 20 days. But obviously, the question is, what if they had chosen not to destroy it? What would have been the outcome? What kind of creature could have resulted from this experiment? And all the questions, the ethical questions that come with this.
Right. And perhaps we should also briefly mention that this is not, I mean, it is new in this form, but it is not entirely new that human beings have animal parts in them, for example. Yeah. So when we transplant or when we implant heart valves into humans, often animal heart valves are used from pigs, or pig insulin is used in the treatment of diabetics. So yeah, you do have other situations in which animal products or parts of animals become parts of the human body. But this obviously is different what we are talking about it now, right?
It is different because here you are producing something new, mixing the cells of two different species. It's not the same as taking an organ from an animal that's fully the animal's organ. It's really creating a new kind of being that is potentially half human, half whatever animal we're using.
Right. And so there is a name, perhaps we should briefly mention the word, for these animals that are mixed from animal and human cells into one organism. It seems the American pronunciation for this is chimera. I will, in the YouTube video, I will write the word there. How would you pronounce it as a French?
So in French, we would say chimère, and it's interesting because chimère can refer to this creature, but also in the common language, it has become some kind of a dream. A chimère is sometimes an ideal people may have about something, some kind of unrealistic dream about something. And it produces the adjective chimérique, which is basically unrealistic, but often in a good way, something you dream about, but is very unlikely to happen.
Right. And unrealistic, this is, I think, where it comes from, because this is an ancient Greek mythological mm-hmm. creature that is a lion with a goat's head yeah. and a tail made of a snake. So this is unrealistic, right? And this is where this originally comes from. And of course, they name it like this because now we are creating exactly this kind of thing, right? An animal that contains yeah. these different. And this is, again, different from where you have two cells mating of different organisms, perhaps. And then you create something that is genetically a hybrid. But there you have one organism, the cells of which are all hybrids, right? So this mm-hmm. is a different thing from yeah. what we are talking now, where you have one organism that contains two entirely different mm-hmm. kinds of cells from two species, right? Do we want to give a very short overview of what the main issues are when we talk about the creation of these chimeras?
Yeah, so the obvious problem is, I think, well, first of all, are we justified in this kind of treatment when it comes to humans, but also animals in general? Is it morally acceptable to use any living creature's organs for whatever human use? So we also need to see what kind of use we're making of it. Here in this case, the benefits are pretty clear. People do it not only for no reason or to experiment. They do it because there is a demand in organs. And this would potentially save a lot of lives. Another problem, however, is related to the kind of creature we are creating. Is this creature half human? How human are they? And if they are partly human, do they have the same rights as a human? Where do these rights come from, et cetera, et cetera? So there are a lot of ethical issues, and this is a very touchy topic, obviously.
Right. About the benefits, let's briefly say that I looked at the numbers, and it seems that we have around, in the European Union, around 60,000 people on the list for organ transplants per year. And at the same time, just to put this in a perspective, there are around 90,000 fatal traffic accidents a year. So we have about 2/3 of the traffic deaths are people on waiting lists for organs. So this gives us some idea about the scale of the problem. It is obviously a big problem, but on the other hand, it is also the case that only particular organs are required. So it seems like the most demanded organs are kidneys. And mm-hmm. this is far more than any other kind of organ. The livers are the second most, and then all the other organs are just disappear in the graph. You know, you have a huge spike for the kidneys and almost nothing for the other organs. So it seems that the availability of other organs is more or less okay. The big problem is with kidneys and perhaps livers. So this yeah. might be important in this discussion, because it suggests that the problem is not a problem of growing, you know, whatever human organs, but it's more specifically a problem of growing kidneys or replacing kidney function. So if we had, let's say, a kind of technological solution to this that doesn't require us to grow the kidney, then perhaps we could solve this problem without having all this discussion about chimeras, right?
Yeah, absolutely. But again, the intention is probably a good intention. This is the intention to save lives, and this would actually make a significant difference. Now the problem is, should we consider the intention first, or should we consider the outcome? And are we justified in doing something because we have a good intention, even if what we're doing is problematic on different grounds?
Yes, but now the thing with considering the outcome is always a little problematic when you talk about the future, because we have utilitarianism, consequentialism, which says that we should look at the consequences of an action in order to judge whether it's morally right. But the problem is that we don't know the consequences. And this is true of every new technology. So when cars were introduced, this is always my favorite example. When cars were introduced, people just thought of the mountains of horse poop that would be gone from the streets, and we would have clean streets and fewer diseases, and the cities would smell nice. And nobody thought about all these terrible consequences of cars. For example, these 90,000 deaths per year in the European Union, or the pollution that cars brought, or the rise of power in those states, oil-having states, you know, which suddenly control the global economy because they have the oil. And these are all unanticipated effects of this technology. Nobody could have foreseen these things or how the inner cities would die out, right? We have these problems that the inner cities die out, and shopping malls are increasingly moving to the countryside where it's, or even to open fields where it's easy for cars to access them. This wouldn't happen if we had more cars in the inner cities. So here it seems to be a similar thing. When we try to use utilitarianism to debate the consequences of introducing these technologies, it's not clear that we know what the consequences are going to be.
And this is always the problem with consequentialism, right? We cannot always predict what is going to happen. We can only look at what did intended outcome is, I think. And here, the intended outcome is that people are treated and they live. And from a utilitarian perspective, it seems to be okay. It seems to pass this utilitarian test. So it would increase well-being for a large number of people. And if we assume that nothing goes wrong, some people may be upset for ethical reasons, that they may be a bit disturbed, but it's not like their well-being would be affected. So from that perspective, as long as we make sure things don't go terribly wrong, like in some very bad sci-fi movie, from a consequentialist perspective, it could be acceptable.
But it always seemed to me that consequentialism has a problem, especially with this example, because from a human being, you can get a lot of organs, right? We have like two lungs and a stomach and a heart and two kidneys and liver. So if you add it up, it's seven or eight organs. And not to talk about the, you know, eyes and retina and whatever else you can take out of a human. And then the consequentialist argument essentially would also endorse just picking someone young and healthy off the street, opening them up and taking away their organs, because you are killing this one, which you can do humanely without causing much pain to him. And then you save the lives of six or seven people who need the various organs of this person. This seems to be a very, you know, obvious counter argument to this consequentialist calculus, isn't it?
Yeah, absolutely. So consequentialism has a lot of problems. I am personally not a consequentialist myself. And it's the same problem with, you know, for example, this very classic trolley example. If you have five people on a rail and you have this trolley going without brakes and one person is standing in front of the rail and you could just push that person to save the five people who are stuck on the rail. So if you're consequentialist, you do that. But it seems quite counterintuitive to say that this is morally acceptable. So this is a very classic example to prove that, or at least show that utilitarianism does not seem to address every problem, or at least is not equipped to deal with things that intuitively seem morally wrong to us. Why do they seem morally wrong? Then that's another question. But in this case, I think it's a similar case. It could pass the utilitarian test, but we may still have a problem with it. We still have an intuition that this is there's something wrong. So why? Why is there something wrong? That is a question. Why is this bothering us?
Right. So we will go into this in a moment, what else might be wrong with it. But there is one thing you mentioned before, the intentions, right? Whether intention should count or how much intention should count. And yeah. Then there is this theory of double effect. Perhaps we should mention this briefly. Do you want to explain a little what this is about?
Yeah. So according to this theory of double effect, it is morally permissible to do something that is right with the intention to do something good, even if the outcome is bad, turns out to be bad.
Yeah, or if you have two effects, right? I mean, this is why it's called double effect. So with I know it more in the context of war, the philosophy of war, where you have this idea that you bomb a hospital, you know, and this, if you want to bomb the hospital, this is a bad thing. But if you want to bomb the military installation of the evil dictator that is located next to the hospital, and then pieces of your bomb accidentally also fall on the hospital, then this is justifiable because this is the second effect, which was probably foreseeable, but it was not directly intended, right?
Yeah, right. But also you can, so according to this natural law theory, it's you cannot and you should not do anything that is ethically problematic, even if the effect is potentially good. So in this case, if we determine that doing this kind of experiment is ethically wrong, even if it would save lives and the outcome would be better, we still should not do it. We would still breaking some kind of moral law.
Right. And now the question is, what actually are we breaking, or what exactly is the moral problem that we are creating? And one of the ways of trying to approach this is to say perhaps these chimeras are in some sense human beings, or they are persons because they contain cells of a human being. Perhaps let me one moment explain this a little, because some people might not exactly know how this works. So The idea is that you take a pig, and we are able to manipulate the genes of a pig so that we create a pig that is born without the ability to create a kidney. So we make a pig that has a hole where the kidney should be. And now you inject human cells into that pig. And because this host organism, the pig, needs a kidney, it manages to convince the human cells to produce the missing kidney. So this is how this magic happens in there. And so then this pig produces a human kidney because the only cells that are able to provide the kidney are these human cells that you have injected into it. And so when the pig grows, it grows a normal pig with a normal human kidney in it. And then you would at some point, you know, open up the pig and kill the pig essentially and take out the kidney and transplant it into a human. And now this whole thing seems to work, right? They are trying it out and it seems to more or less work. And the big benefit is that as opposed to transplanting a pig's kidney directly. The benefit here is that the human recipient will not have problems with accepting this kidney. If you put a pig kidney into them, they have all sorts of immunological problems where the body will reject this kidney, and then you have to give them medication, which again makes them more susceptible to infectious diseases and all kinds of problems. While if this is a human kidney, then it will be accepted by the body, ideally, right? This is the idea. And then the human patient can live a much better life afterwards.
Yeah, and I think in the case of the embryo, the experiment that has been done recently, it was with monkeys. And I think, I mean, in the, let's say, in the collective mind, we think of monkeys a little differently than we think of pigs. We think of them as being closer to us. So when we create something that is half monkey, half human, potentially. It seems to raise the problem even more. I don't know how this is true genetically, but it seems like we're creating a creature that is potentially very, very close to us, much more than if we mix pig cells with human cells. At least that it strikes us as almost human, right?
Right. And this is exactly why they do it, because yeah. they found out that doing it with monkeys produces better results. The kidneys grow better and they are better accepted than later, or they are closer anyway to human kidneys.
Yeah.
And this is exactly the reason why they want to do it, because it is closer to humans. But being closer to humans is exactly the point in both directions, right? It's a double-edged yeah. sword, because on the one hand, being closer to humans is good for the success of these transplants. But on the other hand, being closer to humans causes more of these problems.
Exactly. So why do we have a problem with this in general? I think we could also just simply reject the idea that we should use pigs or monkeys for human benefits, right? There could be a claim, and there is a claim, that we should not use animals for medical purposes or for any kind of purposes, which includes, animal suffering, obviously. So if you think animals have similar rights than humans, or some kind of equal moral status, then obviously you will have a problem with this kind of experiment anyway.
And this also works on a purely utilitarian basis, right? So you don't need to create any idea of a moral status that is somehow crazily anchored in some idea that the animal now is partly human or something like that. You can yeah. just say purely the fact that the animal feels pain makes it a stakeholder. And then you have to weigh the human benefit against the animal pain. And so sometimes this is relatively easy to do. So these debates come from vegetarianism or veganism often, right? Where you have this idea that the suffering of all these animals in meat production is too much in relation to the benefit that eating meat brings to humans, or at least eating excessive amounts of meat brings to humans, right? I find it more difficult with the transplant example, because there the benefit for the human is very clear, and yeah. there are many fewer animals involved in the meat production. You can say we have millions of animals that are slaughtered there. In the case of organ transplants, it would be a measured number of animals, and more or less one to one, or even one to many. One animal would provide many organs for multiple humans. So it seems that the utilitarian calculation is more in favor of doing this.
Yeah, possibly. It's all about the numbers, obviously. So like you said, if for utilitarians, I mean, there is a utilitarian claim that animals should count, have the same weight as humans in the balance of things, in the calculus, because they can feel pain. And this is the only thing you need to be, taken into consideration in this calculus. So, here, yeah, as you said, also the animals, you could maybe argue that would not necessarily feel a lot of pain. Maybe they would live a relatively normal life, and then we will eventually kill them. But we don't have to kill them in atrocious ways and simply use their organs.
They will live better lives than the animals in meat production, right?
Probably.
I mean, at least they are controlled by ethics committees, and they are raised by scientists, and they are not going to have this kind of terrible suffering.
Then you could argue that you should not use them, because that would be treating them as a means, but that you're out of the utilitarian spectrum then, if that's what you think. You enter the deontological spectrum.
Right. And this argument started in philosophy relatively earlier with Bentham. He already said in the mid 19th century that he's one of the founders of utilitarianism. And he said that what counts for utilitarianism is not so much whether the animal can speak or whether it can think or whether it has consciousness, but the only important thing is whether the animal can suffer, right?
Exactly.
And I think it was Singer who made a case for this. So you want to say something about Singer?
Yeah, so Singer endorses this idea that the ability to feel pain is enough to count as a moral agent in the utilitarian calculation. And because there are many, many, many animals who suffer because of meat consumption, this number overrides the well-being of people who eat meat, the pleasure one may feel about eating meat. So it simply makes eating meat wrong because it produces more suffering than well-being. But again, I don't know what Singer would say about this experiment.
So for Singer, making a difference between non-human animals and human beings on the basis of their various capacities is a case of speciesism. And speciesism is a form of discrimination. Here, you discriminate between different species. So you attribute different moral status to different species according to what they're capable of doing. So for Singer, this is not fair. This is not something that we should do. And this is a form of discrimination that is akin to discrimination based on race or gender or sexual orientation. I think this also raises the question of why we treat certain animals a certain way and other animals another way. And I think Singer would probably object to the claim that some animals deserve a better treatment than others.
We are disgusted at the idea of eating cats and dogs in Western countries, for example. But we have no problem eating a sheep or a cow or chicken. So that's also a form of speciesism. But anyway, so Singer would think that if there is any kind of suffering that outweighs the benefits of the action in question, then we should not do this action. So, but he holds a very controversial view on, for example, infants with disabilities. That's quite interesting. That can seem to be at odds with his theory. So I think he claimed that parents who have an infant with a very heavy disability are justified in killing the infant. Is it correct?
I think so. I'm not sure how old, if Singer says something about, you know, the age of the child or whatever. But yeah, and I mean, this has been an argument in the abortion debate also, right? That there is some argument that is also accepted by national legislators towards terminating a pregnancy if the fetus is predicted to have some very heavy disease. So we generally think that we can do this in the abortion debate, but we generally don't think that we should do this when people are already born. But Singer there sees it differently. And you can understand how the idea is with this utilitarian calculus. I mean, you can say that perhaps a child that is very heavily disabled does not have any prospect of happiness in his own life, in its own life. And also it creates costs for the parents, unhappiness in the family, and perhaps costs for society. And all these costs outweigh any potential benefits from the existence of this child. So I'm not saying that this is a very good idea, but this is, I think, how this result comes about.
Yes, I think this is where you start hitting the limit of utilitarianism. Though, I mean, to be fair, Singer seems to bite the bullet, and he seems to admit that a child with a very heavy disability is probably weighs probably a bit less in the balance than a chicken that is healthy and can have a very fulfilling chicken life.
This also brings me to this idea that perhaps with Aristotle we can talk of a kind of conditions for human flourishing, but we also can apply this to animals. We can talk of the conditions for the flourishing of an animal. Right. And so if we do this, and if we then apply this to heavily disabled children or to animals, we probably can justify Singer's conclusion in this way also, by saying that a healthy chicken, let's say, has conditions for flourishing as a chicken, and these conditions are fulfilled by the chicken, so it can lead a perfect chickeny life, while a heavily disabled human being cannot live a flourishing life as a human being, right? So this would be perhaps a way how we could justify a conclusion like that.
Yeah, you're right. Some kind of Aristotelian teleological view.
Right. But of course, opposed to all this are views that consider human life specifically valuable and more valuable than the lives of animals. So this would be something like a Kantian view of autonomy, that human beings have some property like their autonomy, their ability to decide what they want to do. And this autonomy is what makes them special. And this then would apply to all humans who are rational, and this would make them more valuable than animals.
Yeah, so I think the best theory to address this question of chimeras is probably the ontology here. It's probably the most helpful. So according to the ontology, people, human beings, or persons, let's say, because maybe we should also distinguish human beings and persons. But anyway, we can talk about this later. Persons have certain rights in virtue of their intrinsic worth and dignity and capacity for autonomy, right? This is why, for Kant, for example, we're justified in treating an animal, a non-human animal, a certain way, but we should not treat people the same way. We should not treat people as means. And we should make sure that everything we do could be universalized, right? That if everyone was acting this way, then the world would be a good place, at least a place where we would feel comfortable living.
Right. So I think for our discussion, it's important that we have there's something magical in there, right? For Kant, in this being human. This gives a value, a specific value to humans that other things don't have. And this word dignity, even Kant gives this word dignity as an alternative to the normal value of things. So he says that things normally have a kind of exchange value. So I can, exchange my computer for a car or a car for a diamond ring. But I cannot do this with human beings because their value is of another kind, is of some special, almost magical kind, or religious kind, that is not comparable to other things in terms of value. So normal things have an exchange value, and humans, instead of having a value, have a dignity, right? This is what Kant seems to want to say.
Exactly. And so we seem to have all embraced this idea, right? As a society, most of us believe that people have intrinsic worth just because they're people and they're worthy of respect. You could challenge this idea. You could, we may wonder, where does that come from? Why do we have rights? Why do we have intrinsic value? Why aren't we exchangeable?
I don't think that our societies really seriously have adopted this idea. We pay some kind of lip service, but if you see how we treat people, we generally tend, especially in capitalism, we tend to treat people as units, and our economy, our economic theories talk of consumers as units, and utilitarianism talks of humans as units of happiness. And our human resources departments in big companies treat us as numbers. You know, you're just one person in this university or in this company. And if you don't want to do this job, you will be replaced with somebody else who will do the same job. So it doesn't seem like we are really doing what Kant thinks to embrace the dignity and the special value of a person. We are saying this, but in reality, we do treat humans as expendable and as replaceable.
Yeah. So I think you're absolutely right. And also historically, we certainly have not always done that. But I think there's a difference between what we actually do and what we say we value. Very little people will tell you that they're against this idea that people have rights, right? And they can just treat people whoever they want and use them for whatever purpose. So we kind of, we're attached to this idea that people have rights because we also realize that maybe someday we will need to claim these rights for ourselves, right? But still, we don't really, you're right, we don't act, we don't apply these principles in our daily life. Maybe we do as individuals, we try to be relatively kind to each other, but certainly not as society. But still, we always refer to human rights when we try to justify anything or claim anything. So we seem to really like this idea.
Does it mean that this idea resonates with something that we all collectively recognize as true, even though we don't always act on it? I don't know.
It seems to be, you know, like you said, there seems to be some contradiction or some tension between how we like to perceive ourselves and how we actually treat each other, right? Not as individuals necessarily, but as a society, where we talk about, even the talk about consumers, or when you look at all this advertising speech where you talk about eyeballs or you talk about views of an ad. Mm-hmm. And so these are all ways of dehumanizing human beings, right?
Yeah.
Military is another example of this in the military, right? You explicitly, you stick everyone in a uniform, all the uniforms are identical. And the point is to not recognize that these are human beings. And interestingly, this is the same what prisons do, what concentration camps do, right? One of the first things is to stick people into uniforms in order to deny their individuality.
Yeah. Exactly. How do you think we can answer this question of is it morally permissible to produce chimeras, use chimeras for our own good in light of deontology? Do you think there's a deontological argument for the use of these creatures?
Yeah, we have to distinguish, I think, whether we talk about the rights of these creatures themselves or about the rights of human beings, perhaps the patients who are affected by this, or perhaps what in future might happen with these creatures if they develop further. So in the beginning, you would say just having a few human cells produce a kidney inside a pig doesn't seem to be something that touches on human dignity, because Kant is pretty clear that dignity comes from autonomy, and this kidney doesn't have any autonomy despite it having human cells. Mm-hmm. So there doesn't seem to be a problem there. But if you... Of course, if you want to talk about the animal, if you want to talk about the pig, you might want to say that the pig perhaps has a dignity, right? Independently of the human cells, the pig itself is going to be sacrificed and it's going to be treated as a means only. And perhaps we might have the opinion that the pig itself has a value that is independent of our instrumental value that we give it in the production of these kidneys.
Yeah, but Kant would probably not agree that the pig has dignity, right?
He would probably exclude the pig and any non-human animal from the moral scope.
Because, as you said, you can only be a moral agent if you are rational or if you can be autonomous. And that's not the case for a pig. That's why there is a big loophole in Kant's theory regarding animals.
Right. But this, again, also causes these big problems we have with people in a coma, for example, or people born without brains or with some damaged brain, where you have people who never become conscious, but they are clearly human beings. And now the question is, if you apply this Kantian measure to them, then you would have to say that these kinds of humans should not partake of human rights. They are not real humans because they lack the autonomy that grounds human dignity. And this we also don't want to do, right? We want to accept every being that looks biologically human. And we often just go by the looks, right? It has two arms and two legs and a human face. And so we say they should have human rights, although perhaps it does not have any mental functioning.
Yeah, right. So this is also where we hit the limits of Kant's theory, because we obviously don't want to accept that it'd be okay to treat infants or people in vegetative states any which way. So
I think this is where we have to draw a line between what is it to be human, what is it to be a person, because human and person are not necessarily the same things.
Potentially, you could be human without being a person. And you could also imagine a world where you have persons that are not human. So you're talking about physical traits, where we could imagine a world where we create some kind of robots with some kind of free will, rationality, consciousness. That would be just completely made out of whatever material. So that would be, they would probably meet the conditions for personhood, but
so you mentioned Warren there, right? With the conditions for personhood.
So Warren is a philosopher who has she came up with conditions for personhood. So what makes a person or a human a person? This is mostly helpful in the context of abortion, right? Because this is also the big question. When does the fetus start to be a person? And because we attribute rights to a person, we don't necessarily attribute rights to something that has human DNA only, right? So Warren says that personhood depends on five traits, which are consciousness, rationality, capacity for self-motivated activity, capacity to communicate, and self-awareness. So you need to meet these five to be a person. So according to her, then a fetus, at least at the very beginning of a pregnancy, is not a person. Therefore, we don't have moral obligations towards a fetus. So, we may wonder here if this is applicable to these chimeras. So if we determine that they don't have these traits, then they're not a person, and then we don't have to treat them a certain way. We don't owe them any sort of specific treatment.
Right. Then they would be, even if they develop to be humans, they would be humans, but not persons,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
But again, we don't seem to be doing this, right? We seem to grant the status of protection and of rights to even to beings who do not fulfill these criteria.
Exactly. There seems to be something wrong with this definition, for sure.
Right. And now in this respect, there's this other fear that perhaps in these chimeras we are going to create something more human than we actually intended. So mm-hmm. the intention is to create a kidney in a pig, but we cannot exclude the possibility that these human cells that we inject into the pig will develop into brain cells. And yeah. there has been a somehow disturbing experiment there. They tried to insert human brain cells in mice, and they found out that the human brain cells could outcompete the brain cells of the mice in the development of the brain. And so as the mouse developed, it turned out that they injected human brain cells into mice, and the resulting animals had mostly human white matter in their brains. And then they found out that these mice learned better than normal mice, and their brain plasticity was higher. So the structures in the brain were more able to change and to learn than it would be with normal mice. So these cells developed into more than mice brain, right? Into a more human brain than originally would be in the mouse. And so this already has happened. I can put, I will put the citation in the show notes for this so you can look it up. And then in the discussion of this, the paper which I read, which I will also put in the show notes, this said that, okay, this is not a problem because pigs normally develop to full maturity in 3 months, while human embryos need 9 months. And so we can always stop the growth of the pig after 3 months, and then it will not develop into a human. But this seems to be a particularly bad argument, right? I thought. To create something that potentially would develop into something like a human being, and then to just kill it after 3 months and then argue that this now is morally right because I killed it early enough so that it won't develop. What do you think of this whole problem area?
I think the question here is how human must the brain be to be considered a human brain and therefore worthy of respect? What percentage of humanhood does it have so that we attribute rights to this being?
Who decides of that? Also, how do you evaluate one's rationality, especially an animal's rationality, when they have no capacity to speak, you know?
So given all these difficulties, I simply don't know how we can come up with a limit that is not purely arbitrary. But to start anything, knowing that we will interrupt the action, and for this interruption to be the only reason the action is morally acceptable, seems to be problematic. It doesn't seem to make a lot of sense logically. So I don't think we're justified in doing anything that we know could would result in something potentially problematic, but doing it only because we know we are going to interrupt the process. I guess we could draw a parallel with pregnancy. I don't know if one may choose to get pregnant, knowing fully that they will have an abortion at some point, but still choose it for some other reason. We would probably have an issue with that.
Right. And there was this other proposal to put suicide genes into these organisms that make sure that the animal is killed. It's not survivable, right? That it has to be, that it will be killed after a period of time. But this again doesn't seem right. This seems to cause this Blade Runner problem, right? Where you had in the first Blade Runner movie, you had these androids who were programmed to die after a particular period has passed. And yeah. this was the whole moral point of this movie, that this seems to be a bad idea, right? To have suicide yeah. genes inside an organism that could in yeah. principle develop, but you artificially stop it from developing. And the thing you said before about recognizing whether the animal has reached a particular stage in its development, this even seems to be problematic if it does not become quite human. So imagine mm-hmm. we start with a pig, and this pig now develops mentally into a stage similar to a monkey. We don't object necessarily to monkeys existing. We are used to it, and we can, you know, appreciate the existence of monkeys. But to create a pig that has the brain of a monkey would seem to be something very wrong. Although we are fine with pigs and we are fine with monkeys. So even if no human or personhood yeah. is involved, it still seems to be a perversion of the normal run of nature.
Yeah, it's interesting you use the word perversion. So I think maybe we can briefly talk about a religious argument against this kind of activity. So here we could argue from a more religious, or at least a more conservative perspective, that we are messing with the natural order of things. So obviously we don't always think the natural order of things is right, because nature can do all kinds of stuff that have nothing to do with morality, right?
But I think if you're very religious, it is very likely that you may have a problem with this. And let's talk about Christianity, because this is what I'm familiar with. So if you're Christian, you probably think that human beings are unique because they have been made at the image of God, and therefore they have some kind of intrinsic value that non-human animals don't have. And when you are experimenting this way, you are playing with something that is in many respects sacred. And you are also interfering with God's will. God's will regarding humans and non-humans. I think there is also, and it's not necessarily a good thing at all, but a general mistrust regarding science in at least the Christian community. I'm not saying every Christian, but at large, there may be a lot of people who question the legitimacy of science.
Yes.
They may think science is the instrument of the devil, for example. I don't know. I mean, it's obviously not what every Christian thinks, but if we think about the potential reaction of Christians to this problem of chimeras, I could definitely picture some people coming up with this kind of claim.
Yeah, although it seems to be less clear than you just seem to present it. So overall, 60%, around 60% of Protestants are against genetic engineering, and 40% are in favor, I found in a statistic. This is not as clear as one would perhaps expect. It is not like 80-20. It is 60-40, yeah, which is a more balanced view. And it's pretty much the opposite if we look at Jewish people. So Jews have 40 opposed and 60 in favor. So it seems that the Jewish religion is more accepting of the need, perhaps, to use whatever technical means we have in order to save the lives of these patients or of benefiting them. I'm also not entirely sure how the religious argument works, because you know, one would expect that if God really didn't want us to do this, then it would be impossible. So the fact that it is possible according to the laws of nature and that we can actually do it seems to suggest that God at least has considered the possibility of us doing this thing. So this is a little difficult. It goes then into these questions of why does, for example, evil exist?
Yeah.
And perhaps it's a related question, you know, is this something, is this a kind of temptation that is put there for us to avoid it? Or is this something that we might do because we have the ability to do it?
Yeah, so this obviously brings up the problem of evil, which is a very big problem that we're not going to solve here. But the fact that we can do something doesn't mean God wants us to do it, because there's a lot of things we can do that God absolutely doesn't want us to do. But I think the Christian argument here is that God has given us free will. And that's what makes our good actions good, you know. And it's a similar argument with deontology, you know. We are capable of morality because we are also capable of doing wrong things, right? So it makes our moral actions valuable. If we could only do right things, then we would simply act like with our instincts, like animals, and nothing we do would have any moral value. We don't think animals are moral beings. I mean, we don't think that they are doing things right or wrong. They're just acting. So our free will here is what makes our actions somewhat valuable. That's also true from a Christian perspective. So here, God, let's say, doesn't want us to mix these cells, but we can still do it. But then, obviously, if we do it, there'll be consequences.
Okay, so let me bring one other argument in. One could also ask, what about the dignity of the animal? Perhaps we didn't talk enough about this. We talked about Singer, but perhaps there is another argument that the animal, which is the host for these organs growing in it, should also have some consideration as an animal. And then we could perhaps make an argument based on not utilitarianism and pain,
yeah,
but based on the natural development of this animal, that the animal has a right to lead a life that is natural for this animal and to, you know, flourish in its own way. And we could say that if the animal is just used as a host for a human organ, and perhaps previously its own development of its organs is suppressed genetically, that we are creating something intentionally that we know will not have a life that is appropriate to this kind of animal. Would this cause a moral problem?
I think so. I think we can attribute value to animals even without being utilitarian. That is not only based on pain, that is also based on the fact that they're living creatures and that they deserve some form of respect, and at least they deserve to have a normal life as the creature they are. So a chicken deserves to have a normal chicken life, and a tree deserves to have a normal tree life. This can, you can apply this to anything that is alive in some ways. It doesn't mean we should never do anything with them. Like, obviously, we eat plants, right? Even if plants have some kind of life, but that is still different from the life of animals. But I think we can value their life just in and of itself. So we can have some kind of deontological argument for the value of animal life. Yeah.
And even eating animals would not necessarily be forbidden according to this view, because we would look what is the life of the animal before it is eaten. Just being dead and eaten is not necessarily something that destroys your flourishing. I mean, it does, but you can flourish before that, right? So if the animal has a natural life before being killed and eaten, then you can argue that, for example, chickens, you know, that live on a on a kind of small farm situation, and they mm-hmm. live in the wild, and they can outside, and they can, you know, eat whatever chickens naturally eat and move around freely and so on, and are treated well, then there doesn't seem to be a big problem if after they fulfill, you know, their biological destiny, which is to procreate, right? If afterwards, you know, they're killed in a painless way and eaten. This would be much different from raising an animal in a lab environment that is only there in order to provide organs.
That is different. It makes it more morally permissible. I still don't know if it fully is morally permissible to eat them. I eat meat myself, so I'm very hypocritical here, but we're still eating, we're still killing them, we're still using them for our own benefit. I don't see a lot of justification for that, but again, I eat meat and I'm willing to be paradoxical here. But I think it makes it more okay, obviously, but I don't know if it still is fully acceptable.
Right. And finally, perhaps before we finish this, there would be this argument, should we, and it's a similar argument we had already when we talked about space, should we go there even? And should we even embrace this kind of medicine? Is it a good idea to even have this kind of medicine when we know that we are benefiting around 60,000 people a year in the European Union? At the same time, when we look at people who are dying all over the world because of poverty and preventable diseases, we have around 15,000 children under the age of five dying from poverty and preventable diseases every day. So this means in 4 days you have 60,000 children dead worldwide. And this is as many people as we save per year through organ transplants in the European Union.
Right.
So the question is this even justifiable on these grounds, or do we need to say that we are just putting a lot of effort here into a kind of technology that benefits very few, and all the money spent on this research and on these institutions and these hospitals and this technology, this should better be diverted towards saving the children who die, you know, in 4 days from poverty.
Yeah, exactly. So this is maybe where we want to be a little utilitarian and consider how many people are benefiting from what we're doing and what we could do instead. When it comes to space, for example, I always feel like there's enough problems here on Earth. Why don't we just focus on this instead of spending all that money for space where none of us is likely to ever go? And there are priorities, is my point. I always have, you know, thought this way. So you may argue that, in fact, there are priorities here. Some people, I mean, a lot of people suffer because of things that we could easily stop or modify. And maybe it would be more important to look at this before we try some kind of crazy experiment. Then I don't know if it's all about the number. I don't know, even if the number of people who benefit from that is small, maybe the experiment is still worthwhile, though I don't think any kind of experiment is worthwhile. I don't think the outcome, however positive it may be, always justifies the action. And I think in this case, the action is potentially too problematic to be justifiable, even if the outcome is positive.
Okay, let's end it here then on this note. And of course, we don't know still whether it is permissible or not, but that's not the point of philosophy, right? We are just...
Yeah, we ask questions. We don't have to answer them. Yeah.
Exactly. Okay, so what do we talk about next time?
So next time we talk about death penalty.
The death penalty, and particularly this problem of the availability of medicines that are used to kill people in the United States, and whether the countries that produce these drugs should export them to the United States or not, right? This is one of the things that was in the news. Okay. So thank you. See you next week.
Thank you. See you next week.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.